This is a HeadGum Podcast.
In 86, N.M. Martin wrote the first book of what became a cult. Now it's time for Babysitter's Club.
Dude, this is a fucking important book.
Yeah, I agree.
This is a devastating book. It's the fucking end of the road.
I hated it. I mean, I loved it. I thought it was a brilliant book. It was like a dream team. It was like Anne pulled out all her biggest guns for this one. Anne was in the mix. You better believe our boy Pete Laurentius was in the mix.
Oh, he did such a good job.
Hodges was doing some buck wild shit on the cover.
Yeah. It was the dream team of Anne, Pete, and Hodges forming like Voltron to create a masterpiece. This book, and I've got to say, the last couple books we've read, we haven't maybe enjoyed quite as much as some of the others, but boy, what a fantastic send-off for Dawn.
Yeah, well, spoilers.
Yeah, the book is called, like, Dawn Leaves.
Yeah. Dawn's Big Move.
Dawn's Big Move is the name of the novel. It's a masterpiece. I want to get right into talking about it, but first, I want to talk about introducing our show.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi. I went out to drinks tonight after work. Okay. Some of our friends from Japan are in town. They all miss you.
That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to introduce a show, though, right?
I just catching up with you. This isn't for the show.
Okay, good.
It's just like, you know, they're all in town for onboarding.
Yeah.
And we're all looking for you. I showed them the pillow, at least.
I don't think anybody knows about the pillow, Tanner.
All of our coworkers do. Do you mean Baby Nation?
Yeah. Baby Nation probably.
Baby Nation, I am. This isn't going to make the edit. I was just trying to have a conversation with my friend Jack. But I made some time ago a full length, life size body pillow of Jack Shepard. I had him pose in kind of a saucy pose.
Yeah, it's pretty saucy.
And then I sent it off to a company who printed him onto a full-size body pillow and then went to Bed Bath & Beyond, got a body-length pillow, and keep this full-size body pillow next to my desk.
I guess, now that you mention it, probably anyone could have one.
Should we do me on one side and you on the other?
That's pretty good. That's good marketing.
Yeah. We'll sell that on our e-shop.
Yeah.
As soon as we get around to building an e-shop.
Well, that's nice that I'm still keeping you company. You got it out? You got it out of your system? You want to introduce the show with me?
Got it out. I'm trying to open my book on my iPad here. It's not opening, so I guess I won't look at my notes. Is that okay?
Listen, I really do want to introduce this show.
I wish you would. Hi. I wish you would. I don't know what's stopping you from doing it.
It's you. It's literally you. Hi, and welcome to the Babysitter's Club.
Club.
A podcast in which I, Jack Shepard,
and I, Tanner Greenring,
talk about the classic novels of Princeton's own Princess Anne Matthews Martin, Soul Skinner,
Priestess.
Sanctified,
Priestess
Stormborn, Anne. Stormwalker, Priestess, Bat's Bane, first of her name, last of her kind, last hope for humankind. Boy, that is becoming a fucking mouthful.
And you've cut several.
Yeah, I've cut a bunch when we added Priestess.
Right, that was Baby B. Beth Ann.
Yeah.
Added that honorific.
She knows something we don't know. It just felt real right.
Right.
Those are Anne's epithets, her book that she wrote this week. You like that segue, Tanner? Her book that she wrote this week was called Dawn's Big Move.
Mm-hmm. It was about a BM. Yes!
A big move.
Yeah, a big BM.
No, it was about a BM, which is a big move.
Oh, yeah. Well, it should have
just
been called...
That's what BM stands for.
It should have just been called Dawn's BM.
Yeah, Dawn's BM. Yeah, Dawn's Big Move or Dawn's BM,
yeah.
Whichever. DBM.
I'm sure Pete pitched that. And like Anne was on board, but the Scholastic lawyers are like, oh, do you think people will mix it up with, well, you know.
Yeah.
And Pete's like, no, what do you mean? Dawn's BM.
Which leads me to a new segment that I want to introduce here. I don't have a name for it.
Jack, it's episode 69. You're introducing new segments? 69 episodes in?
This is a novel that is about transition. It's about change. It's about shaking it up. It's not about fucking stasis.
Okay.
This I was inspired by this book.
Okay.
Let's hear your name. I don't have a name for it.
All right. Well,
I'm just going to ask you the question.
I'll come in and give you. I'll give you a name, and I want 15% on the back end.
Okay.
Of this segment.
Fine. You know, 15% of nothing is nothing, right?
For now.
All right. It's essentially, what was your Larangis moment this week?
Ooh. Larangis moment.
No, don't use another segment's song.
Okay.
Here's what a Larangis moment is. It's not just the best thing that Pete did. It's the moment in the book where it suddenly dawned upon you, without a shadow of a doubt, that Pete Larangis wrote this book.
Okay. Got it.
Got it? You understand the concept, right?
I knew the concept. I was thinking up a theme song, and I got one.
Okay. That's what you're here for, basically, is Foley work. Okay. So
this is to the tune of Shania Twain's From This Moment On. From this Larangis moment, life has begun. From this Larangis moment, you are the one. Right beside you is where I belong. From this Larangis moment on.
Wow.
Do you think that's good?
I think it's fucking fantastic. I sure hope that you're able to layer over some beautiful Shania Twain in the background.
I'll find a MIDI.
Let me tell you mine since I introduced the segment.
Okay.
It's right out of the fucking gate in this book. Right out of the gate, first paragraph. You add what? Asked my stepsister, Marianne. She looked up from the steaming wok on the kitchen stove. Arrowroot, I answered, and keep stirring. Arrowroot, Marianne said. That sounds sickening. It's for thickening, I replied. Then I realized what I'd said, so I added, understand?
That's pretty good.
Thickening. That is such a fucking brilliant play on words.
Yeah, it is pretty good.
It was so good that I had to go back and read the passage again to get it. Did you have a Larangis moment?
It's a good Larangis moment. I've got one.
Yeah.
So there's a festival in town, an athletics contest that all of Stony Brook is participating in. What's it called? I can't remember now.
It's called the Run for Your Money.
The Run for Your Money.
Brilliant title for that.
Yeah.
It's like a fun run, but they're making money for charity. And Larangis just puts those two concepts together, shakes them up, comes out with the perfect fucking name for it. Run for Your Money.
Right. The Spear family is training for what they refer to as the underwear race, which is an event which it's like a relay race, but you take off a piece of underwear at the end of each lap. Mr. Spear is not good at it. He has comically oversized underwear. He's not athletic. He decides he hates the underwear race, so they decide to do tug of war instead. Boys versus girls. So it's Mr. Spear versus Marianne, Dawn, Sharon. They're all tug of warring. Heave ho, Mom grunted. We gave a strong yank and whomp, down went poor Richard. He landed on his hands and knees, his pants down around his thighs. Mr. Spear? We all turned around to see Marilyn and Carolyn Arnold staring at Richard, these identical twins who live around the corner from us. They were dressed in tennis whites on their way home from a lesson. Their parents were behind them, gently nudging them onward. I could tell the grown-ups were trying hard not to laugh. It's like a scene from a sitcom.
Yeah.
He's playing tug-of-war. He falls over his comical underwear, which he had been wearing for the previous scene, become exposed.
Yeah, and Larangis, it's like Chekhov's gun. He sets up the comical underwear in the first act. Yeah. And then in the second act, lo and behold, those pants come right down. Mr. Spear trips over them.
Oh, not...
Falls on his fucking
not
face.
Not only did they come down, they come down in front of the neighbors.
Oh, Pete.
From this Larangis moment. Yeah. Do you know the song? It seems like you don't really.
Why do you think that? I just sang along with you.
I'll send it to you. I'll send it to you when the chord's done. You can listen to it, really get into the spirit.
Moving on. I want to underline that Pete is multifaceted. He does pratfalls. He does wordplay. He does comedy. But he also does gorgeous, beautiful prose. Here's a moment where Dawn, at the beginning of this book, is describing the fact that she feels caught in between two coasts and between two families. Yes, it's true. My parents live on opposite sides of the country, like bookends. That's a fucking gorgeous piece of prose by Pete Larangis. This is what Pete does so fucking well. Both of those things, one comedic and one tragic, within pages of each other.
Right. Also, like, there are a lot of babysitters.
Yeah.
I feel like been getting a lot of Dawn and Marianne POVs lately.
Yeah, it does feel that way.
We had Dawn's Family Feud, and then we had a Stacy book, and then we had Maid Marianne.
Yeah.
And now we've got this one.
Yeah, layoff of Dawn and Marianne, we get it.
Well, we're going to lay off Dawn somewhat permanently now, Jack, because she's been stolen away from us.
What a fucking tragedy.
Jack, just real quick.
Yeah.
Hey, Anne, it's us.
Hey, Anne.
Jack and Tanner from the Babysitters Club. We know you listen. We know we've been pleading with you for some time to not do this thing that you've done. So I just really wanted to quickly say, fuck you, Anne.
Anne, you've hurt me for the last fucking time.
Anne. Who do you think you are, Anne? You don't even write these. Oh, and you know what? And you know what, Jack?
What?
Fuck you, Pete.
Yeah, fuck you, Pete Larangis.
This is how you do us, Pete. We trust you. We trust you with these books. Anne hands you the reins. And what you do to us is you take away Dawn.
You know what you are, Pete? You are complicit.
Yeah.
How does that sound? How does that ring in your ears, Pete? You're fucking complicit. You use your prodigious talent as a prose stylist, as a character writer, in the service of this, of taking away Dawn because fucking Anne is so far gone in her megalomania that she wants to take away something that we care about just to show she can do it.
What are you going to do now, Pete? Like, who are you going to write books about now, Pete? Stacy?
Come on.
Both of you.
Both of you.
And Pete, blow it out your asses.
I'm furious.
I didn't think they'd do it. They've been teasing it for books, but I didn't think they'd do it.
No, I didn't think they'd do it. I thought it was just like trying to fucking move units, you know? Mm. Trying to sell copies.
Right. It's infuriating, and I hate it. I hate the idea. They gave us a little tease right at the end as Dawn is leaving. You know what we haven't done?
What?
Describe this book.
Should we just do that? Or do you want to get your thought out first?
Let me just get my thought out. Okay. Right at the end, Dawn has left us. She's on a plane to New York, and she unwraps a gift from the Babysitter's Club. And it is a journal. Some might call it a diary.
Yeah.
So they kind of tease that, like, oh, you're not going to be able to write in the Babysitter's Club notebook anymore. You're going to need another place to kind of get your feelings out, Dawn. Here's a journal, a diary for you, some kind of California diary.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's a little bit of hope there for us, specifically for me and you.
Yeah.
But I'm still not thrilled about it.
I saw it as a blank, like, she's handed this blank book. It's like, hey, everything that you've written, everything that we've written together, the story we've written together, has been erased.
Right.
Now all you have is emptiness.
Right.
You're a blank book now. There's nothing there. There's nothing more to see here, babies and gentlemen.
Dawn is staring at that blank page before her. She opens up the dirty window of the airplane. And she lets the sun illuminate the words that she could not find. She's reaching for something in the distance, so close she can almost taste it. And she releases her inhibitions, and she feels the rain on her skin, Jack.
Wow.
No one else can do it for her. Only she can let it in. No one else. Can speak the words on her lips. Jack, I think we need to take a lesson from Dawn here.
Yeah.
Drench yourself in words unspoken, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
Live your life with arms wide open.
Mm-hmm.
Today, Jack, is where your book begins.
Yeah.
The rest is still unwritten.
Wow. Are you going to get to the chorus yet? Because I still don't know what it is.
That was it. It's the Natasha Bedingfield song, Unwritten, which I'm realizing now was probably...
About this book?
About this book. I think Natasha Bedingfield is right in that sweet spot of BSC listeners.
Yeah.
She probably read these books as a kid. And she read this book and she was like looking at this scene of Dawn looking at her life unwritten. And came up with her entire hit song, Unwritten. Do you know the song? Feel the rain on your skin. Live your life with arms wide open.
No.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
I don't know the song, but it sounds like an angel is whispering it in my ear right now. Hey, Tanner, let's fucking describe this novel.
I'll send it to you.
Let's describe this novel right now. I'm going to start right now.
Unwritten, Natasha Bedingfield.
Send it to me after.
U.S. version. Comma.
Cool.
Let's see. Messages.
Ooh, a cool time to send it to me would be later. You just sang it to me. I got it, and I read the book that it's based on.
Oh, that's true. That's true. You know it. You know it.
Let me describe this book, and then I'm going to have you describe this book, and then we're going to continue. Oh, I just got a link popped up on my phone.
What does it say?
Yep. Natasha Bedingfield.
Give that a click.
Unwritten.
Give that a hard click.
I'm going to wait till after the fucking podcast.
Okay.
First, I'm going to describe this book.
I feel like this book would have so much more resonance if you knew this song, though.
I'm going to describe it for the Baby Nation, then I'm going to have you describe it for the Baby Nation. Then we're going to fucking talk a lot more, because we have a lot of ground to cover. Are you ready?
Yes.
Doted on by her parents, worshipped by her sister, and cherished by her friends, Dawn Schaefer is the glue that holds the small community of Stony Brook together. But when she begins to have powerful and relentless visions of a strange alternative reality where she is living with a different family thousands of miles away, she faces up to the choice of turning her back on the people who rely on her the most and traveling through the desert into a dark and uncertain future, leaving a trail of broken hearts, ruined lives, and devastation in her wake. Standing on the very edge of the unknown, with everyone she has ever loved receding into the distance, Dawn is about to learn that the only thing harder than walking into the wilderness is getting out of it alive. Dawn's big move. Or Dawn's BM.
If Pete had his way.
If Pete had his way.
Natasha Bedingfield is 35 years old.
Okay, good. She's a little younger than me.
And a little older than me.
Yeah, she's right in that sweet spot.
Closer to 40 than 30.
Aren't we all?
Nope, not me. Way closer to 30. Way closer to 30. You are much closer to 40, so I understand your confusion, but...
Cool, fun talk.
Do you want me to go ahead and do my bit?
Oh yeah, I forgot. I was going to let you off the fucking hook.
That would be unprecedented.
That would be unprecedented. I want you to describe this book now. I'm going to give you 60 seconds to do it within. I'm going to put those 60 seconds on this big bag clock that I have. I'm going to begin now.
Baby Nation, the time has come. Dawn has been teasing it for 5 books now. She's gone. She's Gone Girl. She murders Ben Affleck. I haven't seen Gone Girl. She decides to move back to California. In the meantime, her parents need to kind of figure out how that's going to work. There's this festival in town called the Run for Your Money event, where everyone does athletic events, like three-legged races and underwear races and stuff like that. So all of the families of Stony Brook, including the Babysitter's Club family, and yes, they are a family now, they're that close, decide to sign up. Dawn waffles a little bit, but ultimately ends up going to California for 6 months. She'll be back in 6 months, and the festival is fun. They all have a good time.
And so we've come
To the end of the road. Ooh, this is bad. We can't sync up, huh?
It sounds great to me.
Did I miss anything? There's no other plots, right?
There are no other major plot points.
No.
Tanner, you got it. Dawn just needs to move on.
She just needs to move on for 6 months. She'll be back.
I want to talk about a little bit of the beautiful symbolism, and I think this is down to Pete, the themes of impermanence and transition that are kind of central to this narrative. And the way that Pete does that, and Anne probably in conjunction with Pete, is this constant reference throughout the text to sunsets. Did you catch this?
Mm-mm.
I've got a few. Soon we could see the sun setting outside the window. The buildings across the street seemed to glow with a warm amber color. It was a perfect end to the day. I couldn't imagine being more content, and I began to think I was crazy for wanting to give up my life in Stony Brook. That's the first reference to a sunset early in the book. Later, she changes her mind. She decides all of a sudden that she isn't going to leave Stony Brook. She's going to stay. I'm staying here. I've changed my mind. The room was so quiet, I could swear I heard the sun setting. And then finally, just as she's leaving on the plane, she looks out the window. I tried looking out the window, but the setting sun was too strong. Instead, I sat back. And then the novel ends with a little note that she's written in her blank book, her journal.
Right.
The sun is setting behind the airport terminal. In 5 hours, it'll be 8:45, and I will be home. Do you not think that this symbolism of a sunset as a change, as impermanence, as moving on is beautiful in the context of the fact that her name is Dawn?
That is beautiful. That is very beautiful.
This is literally the end of Dawn.
It worries me. It scares me.
Yeah.
Is Dawn dying?
Oh, almost certainly that's a reading of this.
Right.
Almost certainly that's a reading of this. California, particularly in these Dawn books, is often represented as paradise.
Right. Aside from Natasha Bedingfield's Unwritten, do you know what this narrative reminds me of?
What?
The Dylan Thomas poem, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Right? The end stanza of that poem is, and you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now. With your fierce tears, I pray, do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And that's what Dawn is doing here. She's headed to those sad heights of Palo, what's it called? Palo Bay?
Palo Alto?
No, it's not called Palo Alto because that's a real city. Dawn is from a fictional city in California called like Palo Bay or something like that. Palo City.
So you think that there's something in this idea that what's happened is that Dawn has moved on. It's not just that she's moved.
Dawn has resigned herself to death.
Well,
she fought against it. At the very end there, she was fighting against it. She's like, no, it's not my time. I'm not ready. I'm not ready to go. I'm not ready to move on. I'm not ready to leave Stony Brook. But ultimately, she has to, like all of us. You fight against it. You gnash your teeth. You rage against the dying of the light. But at the end,
ultimately, you go, whether gently or not, into that good night.
Right.
As the sun sets behind you.
We all go and greet our father on those sad heights.
Yeah.
In Palo City.
The flight number that Dawn is on, I'd like to welcome you to Transcontinental Flight 662 to Los Angeles. We've been cleared for takeoff, so we're about to taxi onto the runway. John 662.
Let's hear it.
Then what will happen if you see the Son of Man ascend to where he was before?
This is it.
That's it. She's going to paradise.
All signs point to this being the end for Dawn.
She's moved on. It's her big move. And we know, and I don't need to go over this with you, we know that Dawn books always have strong religious symbolism. We know that.
I mean, they did for a little while, yeah.
I mean, I got tired of pointing it out time and again.
Right. Can't do all the work for you, Baby Nation.
Yeah, Baby Nation, you find some of the fucking religious symbolism, except when it's staring you in the goddamn face. And that's why Pete is good. He knows that shit. He brings it out. He makes it obvious.
I couldn't stop. I was flying. Signs whizzed by me. Ohio, Minnesota, Nebraska, Utah. Finally, I made out a huge sign that said, "Welcome to Palo City." Dad and Jeff were next to it, but they didn't see me. "Dad," I screamed. "Dawn?" Marianne said. My eyes snapped open, huh?
Oh, that was her dream.
That was her first experience. That was her first taste of life beyond the borders of Stony Brook.
She was coming in and out.
Yeah, this has been weeks in the making, I think.
God.
And she saw there the other two-thirds of the Trinity.
Yeah.
Up in Palos City.
Jeff and the Father.
Beckoning to her. Yeah.
The Father and the Son. The one thing that I want to mention before we move on from this sad and ponderous topic is the first quote that I read to you about the sun, about the sun setting.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read it to you again and tell me if anything stands out to you.
Okay.
Soon we could see the sun setting outside the window. The buildings across the street seemed to glow with a warm amber color. It was a perfect end to the day.
Yeah, something's hopping out at me there.
Something kind of hopped off the page there, huh?
Yeah, a little bit.
Just a little bit.
You mentioned amber.
Yeah, I
mentioned
amber.
The color of the buildings across the street.
Yeah.
Baby Nation, amber is near and dear to our hearts. We have a theory called Amber Theory that states that all of Stony Brook is trapped in a time bubble and no one ages past... I guess what year was it? 1989, 1988? Everyone is kind of trapped in a moment.
Yeah.
The girls never leave the eighth grade, despite the fact that it's been several canonical years now.
They just repeat the same year of their lives over and over again.
Right.
Something Anna's done to them, trapped them in amber because she wants to, rightly or wrongly, we pass no judgment. She wants to protect them from the pain of growing up and eventually dying.
But as we know, like, when you escape the bubble of, and I think this was Anne and Pete kind of making a nod to us, specifically me and you, Jack, and Baby Nation, by calling out Amber so explicitly, she was saying, this is Dawn's last taste.
This is it. She's moving past it. She sees the amber. She sees the sun setting in the background.
Right.
And then she leaves, and she's out. She's outside of the Vale of Stony Brook. She's past the amber.
Right.
It's going to be morning in California. And she's going to grow old and die.
We don't know that, Jack, because Palos City is not... You open up Google Maps right now and you show me where in California Palos City exists.
Oh, you know what? Here's a fucking thought, Tanner. I just had a fucking thought.
Tell me.
If I were Anne and I realized that another one of the babysitters is knocking at the door, another one of the... Stacy tried to leave and brought her back. She forcefully brought her back by threatening her parents.
Yep.
By threatening her mother's life. Right. Stacy's good and back. Then Dawn is knocking at the door. Dawn is like, I want to grow up. I want to leave. She wakes up at the beginning of this book. She's like, I need to leave Stony Brook.
Right.
And Anna's like, fuck, I don't know what to do about it. If I were Anne and I was a fucking megalomaniac and I wanted to keep
which
control.
Which Anne is. We know Anne is.
Which we know Anne is. What I would do is I would leave with Dawn an artifact, something from Stony Brook that could control her even past the boundaries of Stony Brook. In Palos City, an innocuous little blank book, a California diary, if you will, where she can keep her little California diaries in her empty blank book from Stony Brook, Connecticut.
So canny, Anne.
Ugh.
You're just so cunning.
Ugh.
Look at you. You just keep a little piece. It's like a horcrux.
Yeah.
You've given Dawn. She can never grow old with that, huh? Over in Palos City, California. I wonder if this will affect Disneyland Daddy or Jeff at all.
Oh, I'm sure it will.
I just think proximity to that. An artifact that powerful?
Yeah.
I think mere proximity is probably going to affect them.
Well, who knows? It'll probably affect everyone in the fucking We Heart Kids Club.
Ugh, the We Heart Kids Club.
Pete, Ann.
If you make me read a single fucking word about the We Heart Kids Club...
We're
I'm
done.
Out. I'm out.
We're fucking done. That's a promise.
Just not interested in the We Heart Kids Club.
Hey, everybody. It's Jack again with a brand new update about the delightful family mystery mobile game, June's Journey. I have been making real progress solving puzzles and getting stuff to put on my cool estate in the fun world of mystery, danger, and romance that's conjured up by June's Journey, a game set in the roaring 20s about a daring young woman named June who's traveling to her sister's estate to uncover scandalous family secrets and customizing her own luxurious estate island in the process. Tanner, unfortunately, is still... pretty convinced by the ad brief we were sent that he has actually been assigned on a real secret mission to uncover the killer of June's sister, Claire. The good news is that after some extremely frustrating conversations with the unbelievably patient people at the Central Connecticut Steamship Authority, I was able to clear up the fracas regarding the steamship that Tanner rented. But the bad news is that, if I'm reading this hastily scrawled missive correctly, he appears to have gotten himself horribly lost in a hedge maze in Würzburg, which I think is in Germany. According to the secret code on the back of the letter, which, to be clear, he's just written this part upside down, he is in good spirits and he is hot on the tail of Grandma Heath, and I shouldn't worry, but could I please send him 40 ducats in an unmarked envelope so that he can bribe the butler, which sounds both complicated and questionably legal. I'm going to keep you guys posted on this, but in the meantime, you can discover your inner detective just like I have when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. I have to go. There is apparently a carrier pigeon at the door with a new message from Tanner.
Tanner, we need to talk about Hodges.
Let's talk about Hodges.
Now. You texted
yesterday.
Yesterday.
Jack.
Yeah.
I had the day off.
How'd it go?
Very good. What I did was I woke up in the morning. I took my bike to Prospect Park.
Don't fucking triangulate.
In beautiful Brooklyn, New York. Yep. I took and then I took up the and down to and down to the park.
Well, I hope you bleep all of that out.
And I laid in Prospect Park and read this entire book.
Mm-hmm.
First thing I did, opened up the cover, scoped out that Hodges cover. Obviously, I had no idea what I was getting into at that time. Not read a word of this book. Since then, I have read all this book. But in that moment, I sent you a screenshot of the cover of this book featuring all of the girls of the Babysitter's Club.
Yep.
Who go to Stony Brook High School. So no Jesse, no Mallory.
Yep.
Sorry, girls. So what I didn't know then that I do know now is that this scene never appears in the book. I sent you a screenshot of the Babysitter's Club standing in front of their lockers, all having a good time, laughing together. Christy is crouched in front of her locker, and in her locker is a conspicuous... portrait.
God. It really draws the eye.
Right. Do you want to describe what is in that portrait?
All right. I'm looking in this locker. There are a number of books. What is notable and significant and strange is a portrait.
Yes.
It is a portrait of a man. He's wearing a V-neck.
Sweater?
Red.
Of some sort?
Sweater or cardigan.
Right.
He's got a smile on his face.
Mm-hmm.
The only other thing that stands out to me about this portrait, Tanner, it is a note-perfect picture of President
Barack Hussein Obama. Right. There's just no mistaking it, Baby Nation. And I sent a screenshot to Jack Shepard, and I circled the portrait, and I wrote in red letters, Barack Obama?
Barack Obama.
And Jack responded, yes, what the fuck?
In all caps.
Yes.
I don't feel like you read that quite as well as I said it.
He wrote it in all caps.
Yeah.
Jack Shepard and I, unprompted,
yeah,
with no conversation between the two of us, both looked at this portrait in Christie's locker and saw Barack Obama. It is unmistakably Barack Obama.
Yeah.
1993. September of 1993. Baby Nation. Yeah. Hodges got into his isolation chamber. He stripped down to nudity. He climbed inside his isolation chamber. He was floating in his saltwater tank in pitch blackness, and he saw a vision of the future. He saw this African-American gentleman who he knew was a man of great charisma, would someday be a man of great power.
Yeah.
He didn't know what to make of it, but he said, I must capture this. I must capture this face. This will be important someday.
Yeah.
And he went ahead and put this portrait in the president of the Babysitters Club's locker.
Hodges. And they tried so hard to throw him off of the fucking scent. We talked in a previous episode about Hodges baiting, which is the technique whereby writers of the Babysitters Club books, including Anne M. Martin, at the behest of the Scholastic Scholastic Liars.
Got him again, hey?
Got him again.
Hey, what's the opposite of progress?
Is it Congress?
Congress.
Good. At the behest of the Scholastic lawyers, try to throw Hodges off the scent of whatever like crazy cryptic shit he's going to put in the cover. Here's the moment of Hodges baiting that I saw in this book. You should have seen the look on your face when you rolled over that oversized ball, Stacy, Christie said. You should have seen the look on your face during the dance relay, Stace replied. Christie cringed. That was so embarrassing. My dad said he got a picture of you, Claudia said. No, Christie's jaw dropped. I think I'll frame it and hang it in my room, Claude added, tapping her chin and looking directly at Hodges Swallow, art director of the Babysitter's Club.
There was a lot of Hodges baiting in this book. Like, yeah. Stacy being gobbled by the giant orb. Obviously.
Yeah.
Ripe for Hodges. I think Mr. Spear, pants down, ass up, the Arnold twins.
Oh, yeah.
Gawking.
Yeah, Larangis is doing his fucking best.
Yeah.
And Hodges was like, no, I've seen a vision of a beautiful man.
I've seen a vision of a beautiful, charismatic man.
Yeah.
Who I know will be important someday.
Okay, so let's dig a little further into this fucking crazy picture, which does not happen. There is no scene in this book where the five non-associate members of the Babysitter's Club stand in front of a locker posing. Here are a few other things that are happening in this. Apart from the fucking insane fact that there is a portrait of Barack Obama in Christie or Marianne's locker.
Christie's, confidently.
One, they are all reading blank books.
That's hard to substantiate with the image I'm looking at here.
The books have nothing on them. Look at the book that Marianne is reading.
It's like a composition book, but the little cover doesn't say anything.
So they're all reading blank books. We know that blank books is something that's come up in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Dawn is given a blank book.
The rest is still unwritten.
It's Anne's way of, we think, kind of keeping Dawn on a leash, even though she's left the confines of Stony Brook.
Oh, you know what? You're right. It is Marianne because she has short hair.
Yeah.
She's wearing the Christie Thomas uniform.
Right.
She's wearing a red turtleneck and blue jeans. I didn't notice the short hair until now, but that is definitely Marianne. Yeah.
It's made over Marianne.
And Christie is wearing some kind of buck wild stuff here in this.
Christie's wearing some buck wild stuff, and she is reading a blank book.
Yeah.
Here's another thing, and I want you to really zoom in close. They're all, like, having a fucking time, right? They're having a fucking fun-ass time. Christie is reading the book. Claudia's, like, making a goof with Dawn, who's weirdly brushing her hair and laughing and looking in the mirror. What the fuck is that? I don't know. That's some weird symbolism. Marianne has turned to Stacy with, like, a look of mirth on her face as if she's just made a hilarious joke.
Right.
Stacy is weeping.
Stacy does look like she's weeping.
She's inexplicably crying.
She's not happy, nor is Christie. Christie and Stacy have been pushed to the very edges of this painting, Baby Nation.
Like bookends.
They're both cut off on either side. They're both barely in this image, and they both have the look of lament. They're both in deep mourning.
Yeah, so what the fuck is that? And then the final thing that I notice in this painting by Hodges in this tableau is that Dawn also has a portrait in her locker. And the portrait that Dawn has is...
it looks like an impressionist painting.
A portrait of an endless expanse of blue.
Do you think that's heaven?
Just an expanse of blue sky. Yeah, maybe that's what it is.
God, that is just... I'm just looking at this now. That is unmistakably Barack Obama.
Yeah, there's no question. Baby Nation, I know this is an audio medium.
You know what, Baby Nation? We have two new segments now.
Yeah.
One is called in this Larangis moment.
Yeah.
And one is called Hodges Swallow.
Swallow Me Down.
Ugh. Yucky. Huh? Yucky.
I was thinking of the Gin Blossom song.
Doesn't matter. Can you sing? It's still pretty yucky, huh? There's a...
I think it's Swallow Me Down.
You think I'm thinking of Swallow Me Down.
It's good. It sounds good. Doesn't it roll off the tongue there a little bit?
There's the thermals. Do you know the Thermals?
Yeah, I do know the Thermals.
They have a song called Saint Rosa and the Swallows.
Mm. There's a Arthur Ransom Victorian novel called Swallows and Amazons. I grew up reading it.
Swallows rough, huh? How about Hodges?
It's called Swallow Me Down, you son of a bitch.
Ugh, it's very, very unfortunately called Swallow Me Down.
What about I'll Swallow You Into the Dark?
That's so much better. Because I was about to make the theme song of Swallow Me Down, Sublime's Caress Me Down. But I feel like...
Not the Gin Blossoms' Follow Me Down? That was where you went to Sublime's Caress Me Down?
Yeah. And I said, swallow me down.
Listen, the theme song is Death Cab for Cuties.
Yeah.
I'll swallow you into right. the dark.
Love of mine, someday yeah. you will die, and I'll be yeah. close behind. I'll yeah. swallow you into the dark.
Into the dark.
That's our new segment. That's our new segment for when we discuss the... subversive cover art of
Babysitter's Club art director Hodges Swallow. Oh, Tanner, I've got one more fucking goddamn thing I want to talk to you about.
One more? Because I've got like six more.
Okay, but I've got one more thing that I'm like dying to fucking talk to you about.
Hit me.
Okay, here's a quote from Dawn early on in this novel. I don't know about you, but I go crazy in the early fall. Especially when the air is so cool and clear you can almost drink it. I just want to run around in the falling leaves and scream and sing. First of all, Dawn, you don't know me.
Right.
And no, I don't go crazy in the fall. That's weird. Second of all, here's a little quote from an article I pulled up called Why Do Bees Go Crazy in the Fall?
Jack, tell me why bees... go crazy in the fall.
In late summer and fall, worker bees labor long hours, collecting enough nectar to feed and maintain the colony throughout the winter. As the days shorten, the bees know it's time to go into this food-gathering mode. Now, let me read to you from a different article about bees, a further article about bees.
Uh-huh.
This article is called, Why Do Honeybees... abscond in the fall.
Is this from The New Yorker? Is this from The Economist? What kind of headline is that?
It's a technical beekeeping term. It means leave.
Uh-huh.
Absconding is the term used when a colony of honeybees leaves its home in search of another and finds a new home.
So do you think everyone's going to follow Dawn in short order here? The entire Babysitter's Club will be in California?
I mean, maybe she's the first bee that goes out, right? She leaves the... Oh, new baby bees.
Oh, yeah. New baby bees.
We're not going to tell you why you're bees.
No.
But we will fill you in on the fact that these books are about bees.
Right. The entire Babysitter's Club are all bees. The entire hive of Stony Brook is all bees. Yeah. I'm beginning to suspect that the entire hive of... Palos City, California, is also bees.
Yeah.
And we know that Edison, New Jersey, is that what it's called?
Sea City?
No. Oakley, where Jesse is from. All bees. Just beehives.
It's bees all the way down, baby nation.
Right.
Why do bees abscond in the fall? I don't know. Beekeepers know. Anne knows. Pete knows. Dawn right. knows.
There's probably a number of bee scientists in baby nation who yeah. know. We know yeah. that we have one. Someone tweeted us last week saying they were an apiologist.
That sounds like a bee scientist. That is a bee scientist.
I think it's an ape scientist, but she claimed to know a lot about bees. So
Yeah, you think it's an ape scientist. I'm pretty sure it's a bee scientist, Tanner.
That doesn't make any sense.
So we do have a bee scientist.
Biologist. She was an ape. She worked at an apiary.
Okay.
So yeah, just like it's like a place where you keep apes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that.
But she did know
just
a lot about bees.
Just ask our monkey scientist. We do have a monkey scientist.
Allie.
And she can tell you. Allie will let you know.
Well, apes are different from monkeys.
Is where you keep apes and monkeys.
Right.
Yep.
But apiary workers tend to know a lot about bees.
This apiologist that we know, who's a baby bee, happens to also know about bees.
Right.
So we should ask her about absconding.
Baby Nation, if any of you know about bees,
yeah,
tell us about absconding.
Yeah. Why do bees go crazy in the fall, Baby Nation?
Ring, ring.
Hello?
Did you hear a phone? Ring, ring.
Yeah. Hello? Hello? There's a phone ringing. Who is this? Hello, it's me. Who is this?
Goliath, this is Zeus. Goliath, are you there?
Yeah, sorry, this is Goliath.
Seems like the signal's breaking up a little bit.
Yeah, sorry about the high voice. I just woke up. you must have thought I wasn't a man.
No. I had your pink slip ready. I had already written Z for Zeus, obviously my first name,
and your surname of course is
hadn't approached my surname yet, but that is obviously Rock Throb.
Oh, Zeus Rock Throb.
Yep.
Oh, well,
and as you know, I am the president and chairman of the board.
I know.
The Rock Throb conglomerate.
Mm-hmm.
And we're an international corporation. We own a lot of companies. We've got a lot of fingers and a lot of pies around the world.
You don't need to tell me, Bruce.
Zeus.
Sorry.
Zeus. What did I say? Rock Throb.
Rock Throb.
Yep. Goliath. Listen, I am extremely, extremely proud of you.
Thank you.
What you have built in that tiny town in Connecticut with Hard Body Goliath Industries.
We go by both. I go by Goliath Industries.
Yeah. It's just, it is amazing what you have done out there, and you've just been gobbling up the competition.
Well, babysitting is big business. Babysitting is big business. It's not just me, Zeus. I've got a great president. I got a great vice president.
I
got a treasurer who's killing it.
That's why I'm calling today.
You want to commend the president? She's really, really...
Goliath, I'm going to stop you there. I am frankly concerned.
Oh, okay.
I heard from my secretary today, Hercules Hardbottom, that you...
No relation.
What is your name? Goliath Hardbody.
Yeah.
Hercules Hardbottom.
Unrelated to me, as it should be obvious from
well, the different
very,
last names.
Very different last names that we have. Yep.
I caught wind today that you have released your CAO.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. We didn't bother to send that back up to the board to the mothership. It's just a kind of routine,
Goliath,
making a few
Goliath
routine changes around here.
Do you think a company of this level can operate without a CAO? What are your plans?
Well, here's what we think. We've had an alternate officer for a long time, a good one, a chief alternate officer, and
remind me what their name is.
this young lady, this 13-year-old young lady named Dawn.
Huh.
She's been doing a pretty good job. She filled whenever we have a senior staff meeting. If any of the senior staff, the president or the VP or the treasurer can't make it. This young girl, Dawn, fills their role. And sometimes I can't make it.
Sorry?
Sometimes I can't make it.
I put you in charge of a Fortune 500 company.
But sometimes I can't make it to the senior staff meetings. And Dawn does this young lady does a fantastic job filling
in. Let me get this straight. Mm. I put you in charge of a Fortune 500 company. Sometimes you can't make your own board meetings.
Grateful for that. Sometimes I can't make it, but I had a system.
And instead, you put your CAO in, a move I commend and applaud, because, as you know, I find the role of CAO extremely important. I started as a CAO. You know? Fresh out of biz school.
Yeah. Rich Richson was a CAO as well, I think.
My dad hired me at his company, CAO. Now I'm the president and chairman of the board of an entire multi-nation conglomerate. Goliath, do you understand? But you put a 13-year-old girl in to make major decisions on behalf of your entire company.
Yeah.
And now you've let her go.
Yeah, we ultimately decided that what we would do is everybody would try to make the meetings.
Okay.
It's a cost-cutting exercise. We thought, what if? I said, what if? You know about blue sky thinking, right?
No, tell me about it.
Okay, well, so I'm a thought leader, I do a lot of blue sky thinking, and one of the blue sky thoughts that
So let me get this straight. I put you in charge of a multi-million dollar corporation, and what you spend all day doing is not going to meetings and staring at the sky.
Just going to look at the clouds, make shapes with the clouds, and...
Goliath, get her back. Get this CAO you released. The CAO is in the wind. Get her back. Get her back or your ass is on the line.
What about if I commit to just everybody in the senior staff always makes it to the meetings?
Hercules, disconnect the line.
Hello? Hello? And?
And scene.
Scene.
What is the Babysitter's Club going to do without their chief alternate officer?
Oh.
We have spent, and once again, Anne and Pete, you have made asses of me and Jack because we have spent the last 67 books talking up the role of CAO, talking about how important it is to have a chief alternate officer.
And now what? What's going to happen if Christy gets sick?
Right. What's going to happen when Stacy dies?
Yeah.
And?
Oh, guess what? Now the Babysitter's Club doesn't make any money and doesn't account for it and doesn't collect dues.
We already had to confront this a little bit in this book. They were worried about Don leaving because they're already book solid.
Yeah.
They can't afford to lose a babysitter, and they can't afford to lose a chief alternate officer.
As far as I'm concerned, it is the one position they can't lose.
Right.
The irony of it is so fucking palpable, Anne, and I cannot believe you can't see this. Any other position you can lose. You lose a president. Guess who fills in? Chief
vice
alternate
president.
Officer.
Oh, no. Yeah.
You lose the vice president. Guess who fills in?
Chief alternate officer.
Oh, right. No, the treasurer moved to New York because her dad got placed in a new position. What are we going to do? Don't worry.
Doesn't matter.
Fucking chief alternate officer.
Right.
Now your whole model is coming apart.
No chief alternate officer. Fine. Who cares, right? Who cares?
Apparently not Anne.
Christy, the president gets sick. What now? Entire corporation falls apart.
The whole thing falls apart. No one's going to stand in to fucking gavel the meetings into order.
Pete, you're great at writing jokes. You're not great at writing business strategy.
I love your jokes. I'm not going to fucking read your business book, Pete. Let me tell you.
Man, I would though in a heartbeat, huh?
Actually, I would. I really would. I would buy it. I would pre-order it.
I'll read anything Pete writes. Jackie, my good, sweet friend.
Yeah. You got a question for me?
I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, this week, did you have a... Burn of the week! Jackie?
Yeah.
You sweet, sweet boy.
Yeah.
Did you have a burn of the week?
Yes.
I want you to tell me about it now.
Okay. The babysitters are training for the three-legged race.
Uh-huh.
In the run for your money fun run.
Yep.
The Pike kids are standing by ready with their sick burns.
Uh-huh.
When everyone was finally quiet, Claudia said, "Okay, there are a lot of events to choose from. You'll all be on the same team. In each event, a team from Stony Brook plays a team from Lawrenceville, okay?" "The whole team ties their legs together?" Nikki Pike asked. Oh, that's going to be hard, Margot said. Adam groaned. I guess you guys took your moron pills this morning.
Woo. Leave it to the Pike triplets to come in with a brutal burn like that.
Yeah.
Get your shit together. Who was it, Nikki and Margot?
Margot and Nikki.
What are you, 6 and 7, respectively? Yeah. Fucking idiots. Oh, you are? Oh, you are 6 and 7? Oh, okay.
Yeah, they are. They actually are 6 and 7 years old.
Yeah.
It's also slightly a pulled punch because the implication is that they're very, very smart and precocious 6 and 7 year olds who, in order to make a mistake as dumb as the one that they've just made, would need to take moron pills.
You believe that moron pills exist.
A better burn in a world where moron pills actually exist, if you'll indulge me for a second, would be, hey, you're super dumb and you didn't even need to take moron pills to say something as dumb as what you've just said.
Right.
Like, for me to be as dumb as you are right now, I would have to take moron pills.
Hey, Jack.
Yeah.
I've had about 4 moron pills tonight. Am I right?
Tanner showed me his beer. It's a beer joke. It's a drinking joke. Nailed it.
Woo!
Oof.
I don't condone underage drinking.
Yeah. You're 33.
No, but like, I don't want Margot and Nikki Pike to be having beers.
I guess you forgot to take your fucking more. Oh, shit, I burned myself. I guess you remembered to take your moron pills this morning.
Ooh, I've had several.
Tanner, we're burning through segments. You want to burn through to our next segment?
And man, I'd love to. I'd love to. Yeah. I don't even know where to fucking begin with this one, Jack.
Okay, I've got a thought for it. If you'll let me conduct this one. First, I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
And the question I'm going to ask you is, did you cry? Did you, sir, have a... How did you get that wrong? How did you fucking get that wrong? How did you get that wrong?
Claudia's closet.
Did you have a...
Man, I cried so fucking much.
Here's what I think is going to be the case for both of us, Tanner. There are many tearful moments. There is one that I think probably stands out for both of us right at the end.
I essentially cried for the last 2 chapters of this book.
There's something that I pulled out that is related to Dawn's mom.
Okay, yes. This made me cry too. So this is our joint and mutual tearful moment.
This is our joint and mutual tearful moment, but I want to set it up with an earlier moment that I think is probably also a tearful moment for you. It's early on in the book. I'm going to read that setup, and then you can read the final tearful moment that Pete and Anne just fucking landed it, and I was just a goddamn wreck. But they set it up with this earlier moment. It's right when Dawn has told her mom that she wants to fucking go back to California. Dawn, you know what it did to your mother when Jeff left. You know what it did to her.
What a fucking monster you are, Dawn. I'm glad you're leaving.
You're just so fucking selfish. Like, it's not just you're letting down the babysitters. You're leaving this fucking business without a chief alternate officer.
Right. Letting down Goliath. You're letting down Zeus. You're letting down Jack. Yeah. You're letting down Tanner.
Yeah.
You're letting down all of Baby Nation.
You're letting down the entirety of Baby Nation. And now you're letting down your own mother, Dawn, who's already Marianne. Fucking suffered the worst thing that she could possibly suffer, which is losing her only son.
Right.
And now you're following in his footsteps. Here's what happens when she tells her mom that she's thinking about leaving early on in the book. Mom exhaled and shook her head. I don't mean to sound so negative, sweetheart. It's just that, well, it was so hard to see Jeff go back. And now you, I've tried my best. Is something bothering you here? Something we might be able to work out? Oh, Mom, it's not you, I replied. Of course it's not, Richard said, giving Mom a hug. Okay, Mom was trying very hard to smile. Boy, did I feel bad. I didn't think Mom would take it so personally. You didn't, Don?
You didn't think Mom would take it so personally.
Okay, fine. She took it real personally when Jeff left. Maybe it was going to be different when her only daughter left.
The second of two children abandons her for Disneyland Daddy.
Well, I know the arrangements would be a lot of work, I said. And if it's too much, I'll understand. You don't know how hard it was for me to say those words. Let me think about it, sweetheart, Mom replied. I can tell how much you want to go. Mm. Richard rose to his feet. What do you say we try that tug of war again and then go get some pizza for lunch?
That's good. It's right. This is moments after he, like, bowled over and showed his ass to all of Stony Brook.
Great idea, I said. Marianne wiped her eyes. Of course, Marianne is crying. Marianne was just crying anyway. She just happened to walk by and was crying.
Right.
She's like, what are we all talking about? Oh, I'm crying. It works. Marianne wiped her eyes. Sure. Mom walked to the rope and picked it up. She was smiling at me. I think it was the saddest smile I've ever seen. That's the setup.
That's the setup. Tanner, this is literally a line that I captured as my most tearful of tearful moments.
It's brutal.
In this entire book. We reached the airport with plenty of time to spare, which turned out to be a bad idea. Marianne and I blubbered uncontrollably. Then Mom and I held onto each other as if we were permanently stuck. You know what she whispered in my ear? Not write or brush your teeth or get good grades or anything like that. She said, let Daddy love you as much as I do. I had to get on the plane fast before it dissolved into one huge tear. It's weird that Anne has been in our text message conversation history and pulled out what I say to you every night before bed.
It's so strange.
Let Daddy love you as much as I love you. I say that to you nightly.
And I always respond.
Right.
We gotta stop texting before I dissolve into one huge tear. Every night, it's like a little ritual we have.
Just another odd little piece of Anne prescience, you know?
Yeah. It's really strange. Tanner, let's get the fuck out of here.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah.
Okay, you don't have any other notes?
Oh, I've got so many fucking notes. This book was so resonant. There are so many goddamn things in this book. I have so many notes.
It's hard, Baby Nation. It's hard when you get a real banger like this. You never want to stop talking about it.
You never want to stop. I have so many goddamn things I want to talk about.
Anything, you gotta get out.
Marianne describes Dawn as looking like the Swamp Thing.
Okay, are we talking... DC
Universe.
So, are we talking Alan Moore Swamp Thing?
I only know the latest one.
Fucking casual.
So
great, Jack. Why don't you go ahead and pretend to know about the Swamp Thing for about five minutes? We'll just cut it all because you're a fucking embarrassment.
Okay, well, I read a few of the latest run on the Swamp Thing reboot.
Uh-huh.
Wait, did Alan Moore do one?
Oh my God, Jack. You've got to read the Alan Moore Swamp Thing. It is so good.
But, so what, reading that, he's a very handsome.
No, the Swamp Thing is an ugly beast.
But as a man, he's a very handsome man. He's got a wife and a kid.
You're thinking of...
A lot like me.
Hey, Jack?
Yeah?
You're literally thinking of Animal Man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Animal Man.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking of Animal Man. Did Alan Moore do an Animal Man?
He did not.
Okay. Tanner, this week, I have been Jack Shepherd.
I have been Tanner Daniel Greenring this week.
In that case, this week, I have been Jack Alexander Shepherd this week. This week, we read a book called Dawn's BM.
A very good title, Pete.
Or Dawn's Big Move. Next week, we're going to be reading a little book called Jesse and the Bad Babysitter. I think that's going to be the new CAO.
They're probably going to bring in some, like, hotshot. They're going to bring in some exec who's like...
What if it's Rich?
Oh,
what if
God.
It's Rich Richen?
Do you think Anne would do that?
I so hope that she does that. Chrissy's going to be like, order, it's 5:30. Everybody come to order. It's the Babysitter's Club meeting. Jesse, Mallory, Stacy, Marianne, you guys all know each other. This is Rich.
This is Rich Richson
from CenterTech. We needed someone with real CAO experience.
We've asked Rich to step in for a little while in the interim until we can make a new hire.
He's 57 years old.
He's got an MBA from
Wharton? Well, that's something to look forward to.
I've been Tanner Greenring. Nope. You've been Jack Shepherd.
Let me just do it.
Babysitter's Club. Let me do it.
We all know who we are. We all know who you are. Baby Nation, please do rate, review, and subscribe. Any little bit helps in terms of moving us up the rankings and allowing other people to discover the show. So it makes a huge difference if you subscribe on iTunes, give us a nice rating, and write a little review. You don't even have to write a review if you don't want to. Just give us that rating and subscribe on iTunes. It makes a big difference. And, Tanner, this is where you come in.
And, Baby Nation, please share this podcast with a friend or loved one.
Yeah.
And if you could share the episode with a friend who is a major celebrity, that would help as well.
All the fucking better. Baby Nation, I love you and I kiss you. Tanner.
I love you and I kiss you.
Let Daddy love you as much as I do. We need to get off the phone before you dissolve into one big tear.
Oh, yeah. I do need to get off the phone before I dissolve into one big tear because we've been recording for an hour and 48
minutes. Oh, my God. Let's get the fuck out of here. Baby Nation, here's another fucking true fact. Claudia is wearing a bra now. The way she talks, you would think the boys had just been invented.
I'm just going to quickly show you all the stuff I have on hand now so we don't do it during the record.
Okay.
This thing.
It's a pen.
Which has like a little sharp pointer on the end.
Good.
This cow. Don't know if this will come into play, but we do have a little cow. Kind of an angel cow.
Okay.
And then I think the most thrilling thing is this new pouch that Jamie got. I don't know.
I would not describe it as thrilling. So, it's literally a pouch.
Yeah. So I got it all out of my system now.
Good. If we retain this discussion in the edit, no one will know what the fuck you're talking about because I always cut out, always, without fail, cut out the scenes of you showing me stuff in your room to distract me from whatever I was talking about.
I know. That's why I got it out of my system now because I think this is an important book and I don't want anything to distract us.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.